correctly, by changing the radial configuration around, could he bring the impedance somewhere up to closer to 50 ohms for a match? Because he can't put any matching things or anything. You know, it's got to be, I could say, stealth. So, I would think that maybe if you change the slope of the radial, you know, experiment with that around, you most likely can get the, because I know classically, I think a ground plane antenna usually has, I think, around 35 ohms with horizontal ground plane radial. So, but if you took them, the radials, and say, planted them down like 45 degrees or so, would that, or somewhere in that neighborhood, would that raise up the impedance close to the 50 ohm stick over?
Absolutely. And now let's discuss the extremes of this one, Mel. If I had a pure vertical dipole in free space made out of relatively thin wire, the impedance of the center of that dipole, the resistive component, is very close to 72 ohms. And if the dipole is the right length, the reactive component is 0 ohm. So its impedance would be R72, J0, close parentheses. It's the usual way of representing the impedance of the antenna as an equivalent series RX circuit. That's my half-wave dipole in free space. And as we said before, if I stop the action at the instant my transmitter is putting out positive peak of its sine wave RF, at that instant of time, when that wave arrives at the antenna, the right hand side, the upper half of the antenna is positive, the lower half of the antenna is negative by the exact same amount. The current I launch into the upper half of the antenna and the current I subtract from the lower half of the antenna are directly equal to each other. If I launch 1 amp into the upper half, I'm subtracting 1 amp from the lower half. Everything is symmetrical. If I put a great big sheet of copper parallel to the ground on this vertical half-wave dipole, I put a sheet of metal right down the middle between the two halves of the dipole. Because of the symmetry, positive up half, negative lower half, zero right at that sheet of metal, no current flows in the sheet of metal. I put the sheet of metal there, nothing happens. The pattern doesn't change, the impedance doesn't change, the resonance doesn't change, the Q doesn't change, nothing changes. Once that sheet of metal is there, I can throw away the lower half of the dipole, and I can feed it between that sheet of metal and the upper half. That's now the ideal infinite-sized ground plane quarter-wave radial antenna. Because half the antenna is there, and I've fed it at the symmetric point midway between the upper half and the lower half, the 72 ohms of impedance just became 36 ohms. So I've now constructed an ideal half-wave, correction, quarter-wave, vertical antenna, infinite ground plane. Now we start making a skeleton antenna. I don't want to put an infinite sheet of metal. I haven't got that many dollars. And I start breaking down the copper, and I find out that I get most of the action when the copper has a circle of a quarter wavelength radius. Most of the action is there, 90-some-odd% of it. Then I go a little bit more into the skeleton area, and I start taking this circle of copper, quarter wave radius, and I start breaking it up into individual ground plane radials. And I start off with 128 radials. And I go from 128 radials after I've tested the quarter wave diameter sheet of copper, and I'll find out it's 99.5% the same. In other words, the RF energy can't tell the difference between a quarter wave radius sheet of copper versus my 128 radials. Eventually I get down to, instead of 128 radials, and it's elevated, I've only got 4 radials. I'll have a little bit of an impedance impact, not much. So I've got these radials out at right angles to the radiator. I've got close to 36 ohms. It's going to be a little bit higher. Maybe it's 38 ohms. I'm not sure of the exact numbers, but it's in that direction. As I start taking those radials and tilting them downward, yes, the impedance starts going up. You're about to say, what's the limit? I start tilting them down more and more. Eventually, I've got them 90 degrees further away than their original position. That cone of radials has now collapsed back into the lower half of the dipole. I'll slowly go from 38 ohms in my guess all the way back to 72 as I collapse them all the way down. Is there a magic position in there for three radials and a slightly different magic position for four radials where I hit exactly 50 ohms? Of course there is. Do you have to find that exact position? I don't think so. If you're a purist doing a laboratory experiment, it's a lot of fun to do that. But there's a magic position where you get 50 ohms, 0.0 resistors and no reactants. Even if you tilt them down a little bit and you're at 42.5 ohms, which is a 1.2 standing wave ratio or something like that, as long as you got a reasonable range of your antenna tuner, it doesn't matter. You don't have to put the impedance match in the tree. By the way, if you did, it's a lump of LC network right against the trunk of the tree. You can hide it under a brown paper bag, so to speak. It's the same color as a brown plastic bag. It's the same color as the trunk of the tree, and the stealth antenna would work. If you want to put the impedance matcher there, but you don't have to. If you've got reasonably low loss coax or feed line at your particular frequency, the impedance matching can take place in the shack. It's called antenna tuner. And you'll get 98% of the performance, 97%, depending on the insertion loss of your coax. So, do you have to hit 52 ohms, 50 ohms, exact impedance at the base of the antenna? If you're a purist, yes. I say you don't have to try that hard. Put it up any old way. There's good news and bad news as you tilt those radials, Mel. You start tilting them down, the impedance comes up. That's the good news. If I don't have a whole lot of altitude of this elevated ground plane antenna, and the tips of the radials start coming close to ground, Earth, and those tips of the radials, although it's a smaller amount of RF compared to the radiator, they do have some RF on them. As those tips start coming close to ground, I'm starting to couple some RF energy into Earth, and I'm starting to get some loss again. So it can become a law of diminishing returns. I'm tilting the radials down. I'm going from 42 ohms toward 50 ohms, in my example, of impedance at the center of the antenna, but I'm starting to pick up some loss from Earth coupling. And my standing wave ratio meter will not show that to me. Careful measurements of how strong it is to my buddy in Pennsylvania, where I'm comparing antenna A to antenna B, two of them side by side in two separate trees, and by doing comparison of A versus B, I can, in theory, cancel out the ionospheric effects. I mean, I can't do that experiment on Monday, tilt them a different angle, and do the experiment on Tuesday, because Tuesday the ionosphere is in a very different state than it was on Monday, and it'll give me contaminated measurements. But if I've got the two antennas side by side, and I flip back and forth a couple of times during a QSO with my buddy in Pennsylvania, I can now find out very rapidly what's the angle of radiation, what's the radiation efficiency. I can compare the two antennas. You're going to see very little difference when you do that, Mel. So we're talking about academicness here, because everybody who builds their first antenna measures the length of the wire to the nearest quarter of an inch on 132 feet of wire, worries about the diameter of the wire, the diameter of the rubber insulation that's on it. Should they remove the rubber insulation? Will it change the impedance of the antenna, the efficiency of the antenna, the tuning of the antenna? We worry about how good the solder joint is, how well it's weatherproof at the center of the antenna. How good is the egg insulator? Is it the same dimension as the one that was in the book? Is my antenna exactly horizontal? Or is my antenna a little bit of a V-shape because of the sag of the coax? We worry about all of these little details the first time you build an antenna. Very similar to your very first child. Every time that child hiccups, you worry and say, should I bring them to the doctor? By the time you have your third child, you don't worry about those details. By the time you've built your third dipole antenna, you'll rapidly realize that a hell of a lot of things you worried about are very, very minor details. But it's nice to discuss them. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. All right, so, Kenny, if you're out there listening, I know you don't have any capabilities of transmitting at this point because of your antenna situation, but I know you do receive, you said, on a scanner. Go ahead and put up your stealth antenna. It sounds like it may just be the antenna that'll put you on ADCW. Of course, ADCW, Dick, is a pretty small portion of what was previous to couple of months ago. It's only approximately 100 kilohertz now. It sends from 3,500, 3.500 to 3.600. It used to go up quite a bit more in the band, and they, of course, the FCC changed around the whole band plan, and so now the CW, which was a big chunk of 80 meters, CW portion has become quite shrunken down, and the rest has been given over to SSB. So getting on 80 meter CW, you really don't have to have an antenna that has the bandwidth that you used to previously look for. So it makes it, I guess, a little bit simpler. All right, without any further ado, as they say, I got one here if you wanted to have the time. Somebody sent me a real beauty here on Q and DB, Dick. So, unless you want to pick up Paul first, because I don't want to keep Paul up. I know he stays up with me many times at 75 meters, so don't believe him. He keeps me up at 75 meters during the week to way past the witching hour, 12 o'clock, I think. But maybe he has to get to bed, old joke aside, and get up tomorrow for work earlier. So maybe we have time, we can get into this question on Q. K2RIW and the group K2KY.
Sounds good, Mel. Let's go over to Paul and hear about what's going on in space. After that, I'm going to read a little bit of this excerpt from William J. Eady, E-A-T-Y. I'm pretty sure if you Google that name, you'll find this information. I'm going to give you a little bit of a question about this one first, and then with the time left over, I put that in quotes, we'll go back and answer some more questions about DBs. Let's find out what's going on in space. Paul, WS2N, you have the floor, sir. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. And, yeah, Mel, I was just listening to 80 meters now while the net is on, and tonight would be a good night. According to the email from the ARRL, I just got hit with a solar blast yesterday or late yesterday or something. So, you know, I don't know if that's going to affect tomorrow night. Usually I try that Monday night. We'll give it a try tomorrow anyway, Dick, I don't know, maybe three little items. Last week I talked about Steve Hawkins going up on the Vomit Comet. It's actually a private plane to pay $3,000 or so to go on these things. They have a private plane in Nevada, and they're doing it, and now they got this one in Florida. I think this one might be operated by same people that trained the astronauts, so he apparently liked this ride, this zero-G ride. He was going to go on one parabolic ride to see how it went, about 20-25 seconds. They did change the landing, well, not landing, but the way they come down, they came down a lot sharper. They came down lighter before he could land on his back, a little bit softer. But three doctors on board said to him, are you okay? And he loved it. So he went on seven more 25 second flights of zero G. So that went okay. Another thing was recently on the news is the new Earth-like planet that they believe they found. Revolving around the sun, not too far from us, 20 light years away. I guess probably puts it around fifth or eighth star or something like that, closest to us. It was the closest thing, Alpha Centauri at 4.5, I think, 4.5 light years. This thing is 20 light years from us. Galileo 581, they call it Galileo 581. 1C officially is the name of the planet. The star being, the equivalent of A, and then there's another planet orbiting closer, B, which is a lot bigger than Earth. I think it's like, I don't know, 10 or 15 times bigger than Earth, they said. Then the next one out is an Earth-like planet, a 13-day orbit, but twice the gravity, although it's five times the mass. A little bigger in diameter. They're guessing 12,000 miles, the Earth being 8,000 miles in diameter. So I thought that was a pretty neat story. The observatory in Chile detected it. Not directly, you know, they infer that planets are there. There's another planet, you know, it's actually three planets in one particular system, the system at, I believe, 581. So they're looking at it. It's an old star. It's been around for a lot longer than we have, our star. If there's a possibility that there was life there, that would be the place to look. So the story goes. It is in the Goldilocks area. They estimate the heat of their star and the distance from it. And if there's water there, it wouldn't be frozen. It wouldn't have boiled off. So that's the latest on that. 20 light years away. Dick, I wanted to bring up another story relating to solar power. This was on, I believe it was on Discovery or the History Channel, one of those two. And I was watching this show, and they talked about the solar panels, the efficiency of today's solar panels. Ones you can buy for your house, put them in your backyard or on your roof. They detect only the red color, you know, that's in light. That's roughly the frequency that they're detecting, and not the rest of the rainbow. They're able to develop at a very high cost solar panels that are able to pick up roughly three different frequencies instead of red, you know, one of the colors are, you know, higher or lower in the nano cycle range. So they mentioned that the rovers riding on Mars, Opportunity and Spirit, have these solar panels. So that's one of the reasons why they're so efficient there. You know, the panels that we would use, you know, whatever you're getting, their size, riding on the back of these robots, you know, I looked at them, and, you know, they really aren't all that big, you know, for all this work that they're doing. Now I understand why. You know, they're receiving probably three times the amount of the power that, you know, that we would get. I think the efficiency here runs something like 10-15% or something. These things would probably get 30% or so efficiency, maybe more. I thought that was pretty good, but they said the expense of making this on a large-scale basis right now is pretty expensive, so that's why nobody's doing it. But I thought I'd bring those three topics up, the Hawkins story, the new planet, and the solar panels. Dick, back to that. This is WSN.
Good stuff. Excuse me about that. Stephen Hawkins, I think his name is. Real good guy. And when it comes to black holes, I think he's considered the guru. And that he successfully, I guess it was this week, I'm going to pass it back to you on that a little later, this week that he took his flight on the Vomit Comet, the nine parabolic orbits. What's interesting about the parabolic orbit thing is that when you're in the Earth gravity field, until you get out to something like a lunar distance, you're there. Mother Nature dictates that the average amount of gravity you experience will always be the same, very, very close to 1G. By way of these parabolic orbits, you can juggle the numbers versus time, but the average is still going to come out the same. During the time you are at the peak of that parabolic orbit, that parabolic crugoid operation, or parabolic porpoising maneuver of the airplane, you will experience 0G for some number of seconds. I think you said 20, 25 seconds. But then you're going to experience 2 or 3 Gs on the recovery and on the climb to the next parabolic arc. And when you integrate over time, the increased gravity you feel at the bottom of the arc and the decreased gravity at the top of the arc, the numbers when averaged over time will be exactly 1G. You can juggle the numbers versus time, but the average is going to be the same. So hopefully he's healthy enough to take the 2 or 3 Gs at the bottom of the arc. That's what you described. That's what the doctors were observing, and they did make it more gentle for him by limiting the ending of the parabolic arc, I'm guessing, and ending more gently in the beginning of the next arc, so that he only experienced 2 Gs and not 3 Gs, for instance. If you're willing to make the bottom of the arc 3 Gs or 4 Gs, you can begin the next cycle a lot sooner, but you're paying the price. The average has to come out 1 G. That's physics. Now, when it comes to this Earth-like planet, 8 light years away, exciting stuff. Lots of people are predicting that. And then we've come a long way here. When it comes to 20-some-odd years ago, people predicted that a nice planetary system going around a sun, a solar system, was a 1 in a million chance. All of a sudden, we're discovering almost all of the stars have something like planets going around them. We went from 1 chance in a million to they all have it. So however much life is out there that we used to estimate, the estimate just increased by 100,000 to 1 or almost 1 million to 1. We're going to find life. It's just a matter of time. And I think I told you guys some of my encounters along those lines. I won't repeat that one right now. Now, since that was taking place in Chile, arguably the world's best ground-based optical astronomy facility, which is the ESO, European Southern Observatory, a consortium of European countries, set up this world-class optical telescope installation, a whole lot of telescopes, in the Paranal Mountains and also in La Salina, Chile, way up high in the mountains. And my good buddy, Manfred Mortenwig, I'll spell his name in a minute, his call letters are XQ2FOD, X-ray Quebec 2, Foxtrot, Oscar Delta. I found out about Manfred by way of a beautiful article on the power supply he wrote in the December 1999 issue of QST Magazine. First half of the article, and the second half was either January or February of 2000, QST Magazine. I met him, started sending a whole bunch of emails back and forth. And we've had some deep discussions about what Mother Nature is doing, what it means, and he and I have agreed to disagree on the time domain analysis of the transmission line versus the impedance domain analysis. He lives in the impedance domain, I live in the time domain. I'm positive he's wrong, he's positive I'm wrong. We both get the right answers. We both know the other guy is wrong. Mother Nature doesn't do it that way. And we're both stiff in our beliefs, in our religion of how a transmission line works. But Manfred, his last name is Mortenwig, M-O-R-N-H-I-N-W-I-G, Mortenwig. He has a German background, speaks Spanish, German, English. Interesting character. And he's the electronic engineer who maintains all of the electronics connected to all of these very exotic telescopes down there. Some of the largest ground-based telescopes on the highest mountain with the driest amount of air are at those facilities. The Paranal facility has had a tenth of an inch of rain in a decade. That place is dry. You can quote me on that. And of all the places on planet Earth where they have sampled soil, water, ice, whatever, you can go as deep as you want under the ice of the Antarctic. You can go as deep as you want in the ocean. You can go to any desert you want, any mountaintop you want, any valley you want, anywhere you want. You take a chunk of that soil, you put it on the right medium in a petri dish, and you watch life grow. Microbes of some kind are there. All kinds, but there's life everywhere except one spot. That dry soil that experienced 1/10 of an inch of rain in a decade in the Parnell Mountains at 10,000 to 12,000 feet in the northern area of Chile. You take a chunk of that soil and you put it in a petri dish and you sit there and wait. Nothing happens. It's dead. That's the one place on Earth they have found so far where life ain't. Other than that life, as we know it, is extremely tenacious. It's everywhere. Some form of life. Biological life. But not there. And he tells me when you go there, in that really high altitude, low air pressure, dry environment, if you're not consuming 6 liters of water, and I think it's per half day, you're probably not going to survive. Really tough place. He doesn't like going there. But boy, is it an ideal place to put up telescopes, and you make sure that they're all remotely controlled so that people don't have to spend very much time there. It's a rough environment. The only place that's rougher is, you know, two-thirds of the way up Mount Everest, the so-called dead zone. So I got to write to Manfred and find out about these, find out the inside information about these planets. On your next go-around, Paul, you're going to tell me where you read this one so I can read a little bit about it and sound intelligent when I send my next letter to Manfred. Interesting character. Now, when it comes to solar panels, as you've heard me guys say many times, I really wish our American government recognized the power, the value, the future of renewable energy and of all the renewable sources, wind, tide, geothermal, whatever. Solar is on the top of my list. Roughly 1,400 watts of solar energy hits this earth per square meter, 1,400 watts. My acre of property in Huntington at high noon on a day midway between March, midway between winter and summer, March 21, the vernal equinox and the autumnal equinox. At high noon on that day, my acre of property absorbs 4.2 million watts of solar power. That's hitting my property. If I could gather 1% of that solar power, as you've heard me say many times, 42 kilowatts would be the result if I could gather 1% of it. At 42 kilowatts, I wouldn't know what to do with it all. So the raw energy is there. All life on this planet depends on what that sun's been doing for the last 5 billion years. That's where our energy is coming from. You could say that wind is a little bit cheaper. You can say that geothermal is a little bit simpler. Say that the tides are nicer, but all of those are not the real source. The horse's mouth, where the energy is starting from, is the sun. And all those other forms are after it's been through a couple of stages of conversion. Let's go straight to the sun. And let me give you another example. If I was building a television receive-only terminal 20 years ago, let me think now, I put up my first one in 1985, 22 years ago. And then they were becoming popular. That was 1985. If I had done it in 1980, the low noise amplifier would have had pretty yucky performance, about a 3 or 4 dB noise figure, and it would have cost me $5,000 for the low noise amplifier on a satellite receiving system, TVRO, television receive only terminal, the old 10 and 12 foot dishes that receive satellite television information. $5,000 for that low noise amplifier. Yucky performance, 1980 time frame. If I go to the local catalog, I can't think of the name of the catalog, Star something or other, somebody will break in and tell me the name of that catalog, where you can buy satellite equipment today. I can buy a approximately 20 degree Kelvin C-band low noise amplifier. It is a large number of dB better than that $5,000 device of 1980. Lots of dBs better, and it cost me about $80. And it's lightning protected, it's got built-in power supplies, it's got the 55 or 60 dB of gain, it's got horizontal and vertical polarization, it's got all kinds of stuff for $80. Tremendously better performance, tremendously cheaper dollar, just because the technology is there. By the same token, I am positive if our government was smart enough to see the potential benefit of solar voltaic, and if we subsidized it, and if we did the research for manufacturing techniques, and therefore we were building solar panels of the performance of Spirit and Opportunity, and that's not the end of the line. Guarantee that 30% proficiency, we can do better than that once we solve the materials problem. The raw materials that goes into solar cells is silicon, sand. Properly fabricating the sand by today's techniques is difficult and expensive. That's what was also true of the low-noise amplifier of 1980. It was difficult in that day. We've come a long way since then. It's now easier than falling off a log, by comparison. So, with proper subsidy, solar voltaics are going to do the same thing. If we had enough solar voltaics in the United States, we would be energy independent. We would not be importing 10 and a half or 11 billion gallons hours of oil per day. I think it's million. I think it's 20 million, yeah. And we're importing more than 50%, so it's probably 11 or 12 million barrels per day of foreign oil we're importing. And we go through all kinds of grief making sure that that oil flow is there. By my standards, we are spilling American blood in the Mideast, guaranteeing that oil flow. An awful lot of that blood wouldn't be spilled. We're paying a very high price for that oil. If we had energy independence, we wouldn't. We would be a hell of a lot better off. We wouldn't need the foreign oil. We wouldn't worry about the oil someday running out. The sun is not going to run out for the next 5 billion years, by the best estimates. The raw material is there. It's time we use it. It's time we subsidize that fabrication problem. I'm awful disappointed that our smart people in government haven't seen the potential benefit of that. It's the best investment in the world. It'll save us thousands of American lives. Boy, that's worth the investment. You can see where I'm going on that one. Okay, where did you read the article about Stephen Hawking? Was it in one of those NASA-like websites, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW.
Well, if you put in Gliese 581 into Google, I think you're better off. If I gave you the website, this has got to be 100 characters long. So it's kind of ridiculous. But if you put in Gliese, G-I-L-E-S-E, 581C, and you should get, you know, half a dozen or a dozen hits. Pick one that you like, and that's the best way to do it. The one I went to, you know, I gave you diagrams, the three planets, and how many AU is away, and all of that. So, you know, they told you about the mass, the five times the mass. You know what I should do? I should down and try to figure out these formulas. You know, five times the mass, yet they said it's twice the gravity. So I guess I could be right, but this particular page is really, they call it the dailymail.com. It comes out of the UK, but there's probably a half a dozen ones you can read about. I heard it on the radio, it was on TV, TV News had it, CNN had it on, so it was around for a couple of 3 days there last week. You can check that out, and I think I said it's probably the fifth or eighth planet, but it's about, don't quote me on that, I'm just guessing, because I have a chart here, and looking at my chart, it looks like if you were to look at Sirius, the dog star, and you look up a few degrees higher than that, that would be the general direction of where this planet is. So it's in the northern hemisphere, and I don't know what the declination or the brightest center would be on something like that. But in general, you know, just north of the looks like the Sirius star, Dick, and it's about 20, a little over 20 light years from Earth. That's a long way. I've heard people say, well, why do we go there, you know? And And if they only realize that, you know, our Voyager spacecraft, which is the furthest away from our own sun right now, is like nowhere near even getting anywhere close to another star. I think 40 or 50,000 years from now, I think it's going to get to a nearby star. So, I don't know. You know, we're going to go with the radio waves, according to this article. Start pointing the antennas there and see if they have heard any of our transmissions, because, you know, we've been transmitting for who knows how long with our transmissions from Earth, broadcast transmissions. Maybe if they had a big enough ear and you know, if they're listening, if they pick things up, you know, 20 years there, 20 years back, you know, maybe we should start listening for a signal. Back to you, Dick. K2RIWWS2.
B2BXO.
MSBXO recognized. 20 years ago, they were probably watching the Jackie Gleason show, but the round trip passed there and back. 40 years, 50 years, they were watching the Milton Berle show. They're going to comment on Milton Berle. That's old news. That's fun stuff. By the way, when it comes to, you were saying 80 meters may be disturbed by the last solar mass ejection, eruption, call it what you like, or the big burst of solar wind that came to us. Today I was at the, I don't know if it's the 10th annual, but something like that, Northeast Astronomy Forum that took place at Rockland Community College, both Saturday and Sunday. And they had something like 65 vendors of telescopes and telescope accessories. So if you're into astronomy, that was the place to be. And out in front of the lecture hall was where a number of solar telescopes were set up. So today, at around 3 in the afternoon, I was looking through a solar telescope with a hydrogen alpha filter and looking at sunspot, I think it's called 541. I'm not sure the sunspot number. The main sunspot that's on the sun right now, and the eruptions around the perimeter. I was looking at that today, but I missed the big event of the previous day that's interfering with 80 meters that you're describing. And my interest in astronomy is created by my interest in microwave, millimeter wave, and submillimeter wave radio. I see a strong correlation between the future techniques of extremely high frequency radio and what the optical people have been doing for some time. They've been building antennas with very high efficiency. They're called telescopes. That's not the whole story. Mr. BXO, go right here with your comments, sir. K2RIW.
Yeah, very good. Frank, WB2BXO here. In Brooklyn. Just about within shouting distance of Nell. I found, I guess, a fairly good article on Gliese 541C, whatever it is, on space.com, which I believe is owned by Lou Dobbs of CNN. At least I think he had something to do with it at one time. I initially looked on the NASA website, couldn't find anything there, probably because I didn't search on the right thing. And I remembered space.com, tried that, had no trouble finding it. So that's as good a place as any to start. And I wonder what kind of gain we would need to hear any unintentional radiators, so to speak, terrestrial broadcasts from that planet, if there are any. I mean, the information is so sketchy and inferential, it's probably really a long shot. There's a civilization there that 20 years ago was emitting anything. Civilization could have been there and gone hundreds of years ago, for all we know. Anyway, interesting stuff. One other thing before I turn it back to you. I noticed in seeing some of the D-Star ads in QST that these D-Star repeaters seem to use a 10 gigahertz backbone. And I recall your TEDx discussions used to have that on MISNET years ago. So I guess your 10 gigahertz work is getting some real use now. Back to you, Dick WB2BXO.
Very fine, Frank. I think you're in Brooklyn. And you already said so, Frank. Just a stone throw away from Mel. So you're where it's happening. And yes, I strongly miss all of my escapades on 10 gigs. And in the last week and a half, I purchased a 40 decibel gain, 10 gigahertz, 10 watt amplifier. Back in the days when I was doing that work, that was an extremely rare animal. Nowadays, they're becoming a lot more available if you know the right people. So I'm looking forward to getting back on 10 gigs. Of all the bands I've ever been on, that's my favorite. And I can only think of one that would be more favorite than that. Someday I'm dreaming about being on 241 gigahertz. That's really a QS flying up to a slightly higher frequency. There the wavelength is like a 32nd of an inch. A round piece of waveguide, a 32nd of an inch of inside diameter, will propagate that signal. So every time we go up in frequency, we find brand new techniques that work. And we ain't seen nothing yet. The ham radio operators, every decade they move almost a decade up in frequency as the frontier. Right now, Tom, WA1MDA, I think he holds the distance record for quite some time on 120 and 140 gigs. And Brian Justin, WA1JXN in Virginia, holds the distance record on 241 and 400 gigahertz. Can you imagine being on the, what is it now, the 3,000 or 4,000th harmonic of 2 meters as an operating frequency? Can you imagine saying, hello CQ, 241 gigahertz, this is so-and-so, carefully tuning the band. That's something else. Okay, I think, Mel, we're going to go back to one of your next, well, I want to give you guys a puzzle. I'm not going to read the philosophy of this great engineer, a little bit on the lengthy side, but in his philosophy, and it's related to what we discussed on the TechNet all 5 or 6 sessions ago, somebody was talking about the fact that a spent battery, flashlight battery, a spent one and a brand new one, if you drop them on the floor, they bounce different distances. And the person who brought that to our attention was speculating that the extra electrons are the reason for the extra bounce, the stored energy in there. Here's my question. I've got a pair of identical dry cell batteries in front of me, flashlight batteries. Let's make them alkaline batteries. Let's make them a copper top. What is that? I can't even think. Duracell. Two Duracell batteries. One is fresh, brand new, and one is reasonably used. It was in my flashlight for 10 hours. I left the flashlight on, and the battery's essentially dead. I got these two batteries on the table. Which one contains more electrons? Question number one. Question number two, and this is an experiment I have done hundreds of times in my youth. Start off with a 4,000-volt, oil-filled, 8 microfarad capacitor. Charge it to 2,000 volts. Got lots of joules of energy in there. Put a screwdriver across those two terminals, and you get something that sounds like a 2-inch salute. And you take a chunk out of your screwdriver, make a loud sound as that spark occurs when you discharge that capacitor rapidly. And you have so much fun doing it, you do it again. But so, assume I've got two identical 8 microfarad, 4,000 volt capacitors on the table. One of them is completely discharged, and one of them is charged. Which one contains more electrons? That's a question for anybody listening. Give me an answer if you think you got a little bit of nerve. KQRIW in the TechNet.
I think they contain the same.
Wow. It makes it sound like there's no difference when you charge them up. Anybody want to challenge that answer? That silence. The silence is deafening. Yeah, he's right. Yeah. When you charge a capacitor, or if it was a rechargeable battery, when you charge a lithium polymer, lithium ion, nickel cadmium, whatever, lead acid, when you charge the battery, the number of electrons you start with in the battery and the assumption you're not boiling off any fluid, the number of electrons you end with is identical. All you've done when you charge the capacitor or when you charge the battery is you've displaced the electrons. You took some of the electrons that used to be on the positive plate and you yanked them off. You put some of the electrons that, and the electrons that used to be on the negative plate, you added the exact same number. For every single electron you move from the positive plate, you must deposit it on the negative plate. Mother Nature dictates. The strongest rule she's ever had is you're going to maintain balance. This is a subset of that puzzle I gave you guys a long time ago, where on a cold day, I put the key on my automobile, and 200 amperes of current flows out of the battery into that charge, into that starter motor. At the first instance, the starter motor is locked rotor, dead short almost, and 200 amperes of current, a zillion electrons, is flowing out of that battery. And the puzzle was, I paint one of those electrons red in my theoretical example, in my think example, my Gedanken experiment, as they call it. And by the way, when it comes to pronunciation, that star is called Sirius, not Sirius. The astronomers pronounce it Sirius. Anyhow, so I got this red electron coming out of the negative lead of the battery. It's going to go down that copper braid 3 feet and get to the negative lead of the starter motor. I'm watching that red electron leave the battery. 200 amperes is flowing, 3 feet of length. At the speed of light, 3 feet would be 3 nanoseconds if it went straight down that wire. How long does it take for that red electron leaving the battery to get to the starter motor? Well, you guys have heard this puzzle from me lots of times in the past. Some engineers will guess 3 nanoseconds. Some of them will guess a couple of seconds. The answer is approximately 4 hours. For that red electron leaving the battery right now, if the starter motor could take it, stayed locked rotor, and didn't burn up, and the battery could dish out the current, it would take 4 hours on average for that red electron leaving the battery now to get to the starter motor. And the first time you hear this, you say, what in the world is going on? What's happening is that there's a tremendous number of electrons in that copper cable. But that copper cable is like a water pipe. For every electron that hops out of the end of the copper cable and goes into the starter motor, exactly one electron must go in. Very similar to water flowing down the hose. For all the water that comes out of the end of the hose, essentially the identical amount of water must go into the hose from the faucet on the outside of your house. It's a pipeline. So if Mother Nature would let you do it, she won't, but if she would, and you want to drain the movable outer orbit electron of that copper cable, if she would let you do it, you could drain electrons out of that copper cable for 4 solid hours at the 200 ampere rate. That gives you a little bit of a gut feel of how many electrons are in that copper cable. But Mother Nature dictates you will keep it balanced. For every electron that flows out, essentially exactly one electron you're going to put into the end of that pipe to stay balanced, or she's going to say, no current's going to flow. Ain't going to let you do that. That teaches me something about physics that's deeper than first meets the eye. It's another example of, if you think you understand the problem, if you think it's simple, you probably don't understand the problem. Very few things are simple. I'm having trouble finding one. Now, Mel, maybe the puzzles that you arrive in your email are a little bit easier to answer than this. K2KEY, K2IW in the TechNet.
Yeah, some of them not quite. This is K2KEY. I was going to ask you a question about the mountaintop. Was that the place where the quad antenna was developed because they could not use the Yagi antenna up there? I remember reading about HC1 JC, was it JC, and his inventions up there. They had some kind of a broadcast system up there, and the altitude, dryness and all created a problem with Yagis that they would hawk over and destroy themselves, and that's when he developed the quad. Is that the correct story? Over.
That's HCJB, Quito, Ecuador, voice of the Andes.
Doesn't surprise me. I'll show you why. If you do a Google search on Passion Curve, P-A-S-C-H-E-N, if I got the spelling right, this guy Passion in the middle 18-something or other year, did a study of, stand by a second, breakdown of air versus pressure of various gases, high voltage breakdown, dielectric strength measurement. And he discovered there's a reasonably linear relationship between air pressure and dielectric strength. Air at sea level is good for roughly 30,000 volts per centimeter. If you got 1 centimeter between your two probes, nice round probes, and you put 30,000 volts on it, there's a good probability you'll create an arc between the two. Go to twice air pressure of ordinary atmospheric air, and you'll get something like 60,000 volts per centimeter. So higher pressure of air will tolerate greater voltage. Aha. You say to yourself, what happens if I go to high altitude where the air pressure is lower? Somewhere around 30,000 feet, the breakdown voltage of air becomes an extremely small number. I forget what it is, but it's a hell of a lot smaller. And as such, a Yagi antenna, which by its very nature has a significant Q of each of its parasitic elements, significant voltage rise at resonance in those parasitic elements is taking place. So if I'm running a reasonably high power broadcast transmitter, and they tend to be quite a few kilowatts, at Paranel, which I think is something like 14,000 feet of altitude, I'll have to go back and check on that number. So in this Andes mountain region, where the mountain is high, you've got a good location for a broadcast transmitter, you're going to get great earth curvature coverage, so to speak, line of sight coverage. You've got to really worry about your high voltage power supplies, your antennas themselves. Waveguides can easily arc over, antennas can arc over. In the case of waveguides, I can put pressure seals on the ends of the waveguide, put dry nitrogen or sulfur hexafluoride inside, and I can make sure the waveguide doesn't break down. But the antenna itself is trying to launch a signal into air. Very difficult to put the antenna into a high-pressure air chamber and still keep the same pattern without the chamber itself acting as a shield to your antenna pattern. So if you tell me that the Yagi broke down, they had to go to a lower Q antenna, I believe it. The solution to the problem, you can make the elements fatter. You can make the ends more bulbous. Common sense would lead you to believe that if I made the elements of the Yagi fatter, the Q goes down and the gain would go down. Good common sense. Dead wrong. I hold a patent for a Yagi antenna where the elements are so wide that the currently available antenna modeling program will not model that antenna. It was found by empirical techniques with a Rode & Schwartz network analyzer that was simultaneously displaying Viswire and gain, and I found this antenna design by putting copper chunks of wide copper tape, very wide copper tape, onto a piece of printed circuit board and keep resonating it and keep making them wider and keep tweaking them to increase the gain. And you end up with a higher performance antenna with a much lower standing wave ratio over a much wider frequency. People used to think that Yagi's had a gain bandwidth product. Well, if you're overly restricting the diameter of the elements and the spacing of the elements, maybe that's true. I didn't do that restriction. So it's a weird-looking Yagi. Multiple antenna engineers from competitive companies looked at that antenna and said, that's a funny-looking tripod. Where's the antenna? Didn't realize what they're looking at. It's got a funny shape, wide elements, and whatever. So by making the elements very wide, I know I can multiply by 2 or 3 times the voltage at which breakdown will take place. All of the available literature on Yagi antennas does not mention this. Therefore, the designers of that broadcast antenna thought that they had no solution. They hadn't overturned every rack, if you know what I mean. Back to you, Mel. KE2KY, K2LIW, and TechNet.
Hey, this is K2KY. All right, fine business. I think I remember now that Rich reminded me of K2KY. What was it, HC1JC? Rich was his call over.
It was a commercial my voice is going. Commercial station HCJB. In fact, I don't know if they're still on. They were on up until a few years ago, the Voice of the Andes. I believe they're a Christian station.
I know they were a religious station, yeah, and I noticed that the chief engineer of the station was a ham radio operator and brought back stateside his antenna, the quad antenna, and that's where it began with. Yeah, very good. I got a, well, if you would like to move on, Dick, I got one here on Q that is really a beaut, and DB. Basically, I better say it's about basically, you know, the subject we've been covering for the last couple of weeks on DB, and this one asked me a question, and this one is somewhat, I have to say, creative, Dick, over.
Fire away, Mel. Let's have some fun with it.
Okay. Here's what he sent me as an email. He says, we could express qualities, the quality factor we call Q in DB. Why can't it be done? Quality factor of various systems is often expressed as the ratio of the center frequency to the bandwidth, okay? Well, if the center frequency was to be considered the bandwidth and the lower frequency would be considered 0 hertz, then why can't the Q be nothing more than the ratio of the two bandwidths? and use the formula, except what we're going to do is express Q and dB, and we're going to invert the ratio so we can have positive dB of values of Q, because the negative values would be confusing. If you figure this one out, this is from, I guess somebody knows some engineering, over.
Yeah. The word Q and quality factor sounds desirable. If I'm measuring a properly assessed quality factor, a different definition of Q, but I'm measuring a properly assessed quality factor of a satellite ground station, I would be measuring gain to temperature ratio. If I had a parabolic dish listening to a satellite out in space, and it's got a gain of 30 dB and 1,000-to-1 ratio, and if I was able to get the antenna temperature down to 10 degrees Kelvin, you'd talk about the gain to temperature ratio, 1,000 divided by 10, would be 100. I've got a quality factor of 100. And if I do something to increase the gain of the antenna without changing its antenna temperature, and I make it 2,000, so therefore my quality factor becomes 2,000 divided by 10, 200, where I used to have 100, I've now got a better signal-to-noise ratio on that antenna, the new antenna, listening to the exact same satellite. So Q in that case, the higher, the better. When it comes to antenna bandwidth, when it comes to tank circuit bandwidth, when it comes to resonators, Q takes on some different meanings. If I'm designing a filter, and I'm making LC networks or distributed equivalent of resonators going into a distributed filter or a lumped filter made out of lumped inductors, lumped capacitors. And I've made a ladder network of these things and I've designed a filter. You go to the good design curves that are in Zarev and Mattai, Young, and Jones. These are the two main books that smart people used to use for antenna synthesis. Zarev is a Russian name, and no, I can't spell it. So phonetically, it's Z-E-V-R-E-V or something like that. Anyhow, and Mattai, Young, and Jones is a famous book, a McGraw-Hill book, which I think comes in two volumes. Great big fat book on microwave filtering techniques. These two books will tell you that when you're designing a filter, Chebyshev, Butterworth, elliptical, and there's all kinds of filters, but when you follow this design and that design, in order for the design to perform as advertised, there is a minimum Q of each resonator required. The filter is not going to burn up and fall down if you use filters of a lower Q, filter elements, the resonators of lower Q, but they're telling you ahead of time, if you don't fulfill their requirement for the minimum Q of your resonators that go into